With Skylab, with your final docking attempt, which was successful with the actual space station, can you give us a little bit more details about the actual procedures you carried out to actually make that docking, because you had to evacuate the vehicle?
Yeah, that's another example. It was kind of serendipitous because we got toward the end of our training period, and at that time we had been in training long enough that we were actually running a little ahead. And one afternoon we were doing an exercise with the Apollo hatch, and it wasn't even in the scheduled list of things to be covered, but one of the instructors over there said, by the way, you know, we've had this procedure with the probe. We're talking about the probe, not the hatch. He said we had this procedure with the probe and invented the capture latches. Don't make that you can bypass electrically. You can get at the probe, cut a wire, hook it back up, and then it just basically, without an indication of capture, you couldn't engage the docking latches. So what we had to do was bypass that and give it a false indication. And Pete Conrad and Joe Kerwin said, well, why not? You know, we have another hour. So they went ahead and got checked out on the procedure. And sure enough, on our second attempt, which was all the more confusing at the time, because if you remember, we had soft docked when we first got up there and hung on the latches. So the latches had already worked one time. And then after the unsuccessful attempt to deploy the solar array, we went back around to attempt the docking. And Pete tried two or three times. Each time with a little more juice to it. You like to float in there about a tenth of a foot a second or less. And I think the last one he got up to about a quarter of a foot a second, which is a pretty good jolt. So then he decided to go ahead and attempt that procedure, which meant the second cabin depressurization, because we'd already depressed once in order to try to do the stand-up EVA to try to deploy the solar array. So it was back with the helmets and gloves on and depress the cabin and open the inner hatch and then get at the probe. You actually had to remove the probe, bring it into the cabin and do that procedure. And I was just trying to stay out of the way since I hadn't been checked out. And Pete and Joe went through the procedure. In the process, you also retracted the probe. So Pete didn't have that to guide him in. You know, that was the probe and drogue concept in the Apollo days, was to help center you up. And he did an absolutely super job because we drove on in and he just basically banged the bare docking rings together and got all 12 latches that made automatically. So it was a super job of piloting, as I say, just the kind of serendipitous that we were even familiar with the procedure at all.
Yes. You didn't find some of the food to your liking on Skylab. Did you find it any better on your mission, shuttle mission?
Yeah, we've made advances along the way. Part of the problem with Skylab was that since the food provided was part of one of the medical experiments, was that it really restricted your options. You had to essentially make every effort to eat it all, and some days you just didn't feel like eating it all. And then if you wanted to eat more, if you felt particularly hungry one day, you didn't get to eat over, except the so-called empty calories, the cookies that we had. It didn't taste bad. But yeah, the food is really pretty good now, I think, don't you? It tastes a little different for whatever reason in orbit, but we've got a wide variety, complete flexibility. We now go, as you're probably familiar with, it's the option of the cruise, but typically they launch with a loaf or two of fresh bread and some fresh fruits. I think a couple crews have even taken some milk up. We don't have any refrigeration capability, so that's probably only good for launch day. But I think we've made strides. Plus, frankly, backpackers have this food available to them now that's so much better than some of this rehydratable food just off the shelf. It's a whole lot better quality than it used to be.
Since the Victorian disaster, Owen Garriott's left the program, and I believe a few of the others have too. Who else has actually left the program since 51? Hell.
Let's see. Bob Overmeyer.
Roy Bridges and...
Roy Bridges was ordered back by the Air Force. Bob Stewart was ordered back by the Army.
Carl Hinnies and...
Carl Hinnies and Don Lind. A lot of those folks, they say, and I have no reason to not believe them, some people had been actively pursuing an alternative job at the time anyway, and other people had just I said, well, shoot, I've been thinking about it, so I might as well go do it now. I really think that the effects of the accident did not cause anyone to say, hey, I want nothing to do with this effort anymore, so I'm going to get out.
It's good to see Don finally got a flight before he had to leave the program.
Yeah, well, he holds the most unenviable record, of course.
Yes.
Right.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Well, Mike hasn't got the answer.
You're doing great. I'm asking a question about the Saturn V. Having spoken to Joe Kerwin and a couple of the Apollo astronauts, they all mentioned the tremendous jolting effects as the stage one burned out. So it was just like slamming on the brakes in a car, and then when stage two took off, you were thrown back. What's the comparison like in the G-forces between a Saturn V and the shuttle? I know they're much less in the shuttle, but
I didn't ride a Saturn V. We rode a Saturn I on Skylab. Right. But the thing I remember is, if you remember on that J1 engine, they had a PU, a propellant utilization shift in there where they changed the mixture. I really thought one of the engines had quit. I mean, it changed the thrust so much that I was convinced that one of the engines had quit on the second stage. But this thing, you get up to about 2.5 G's on first stage.
Sure.
About 2.5 G's in first stage, and then when you get rid of the solid, you drop back to a little less than one. And of course, then we throttle to maintain no more than 3 G's. The whole thing is limited by intent to 3 G's longitudinally. And so you throttle, and 3 G's is the max you see. On entry, I guess about 1.8 is the most anyone's pulled on entry.
I think Bobco had the most of 1.8, which is...
Yeah, and that's, of course, that's eyeballs down, which
how
is...
How does it compare with re-entry in...
Well, nominal re-entry that we experienced from Earth orbit in the Apollo was on the order of 4 to 5 G's. It's eyeballs in, but
difference.
But you're laying on your back for Apollo and going that way, whereas in the shuttle you're upright, and it feels like a lot just because you've been in zero G for a while.
So you're only restrained by your safety harness type thing in the shuttle.
Sure.
You got your full back.
In fact, one of the funniest things I ever listened to is Ron Grabey when Bo and Ron came back on their flight, and we had warned them after the STA that it was they might see up to 1.8 or 2 G's. Sure enough, on the tapes, you can hear Grabey say, yeah, 1.8 G's!
Right, we have time for one more question. My turn.
Yes.
What sort of feel you guys have for how the space station will end out with everything being re-examined at the moment, in particular with the probable reduction of emphasis on EVA for the construction? What sort of space station are we looking at now?
That frankly remains to be seen.
Yeah, but just from the astronaut office. So.
Yeah, and we're probably going to wind up with some variant of the dual keel configuration, but doing an EVA, it is not a risk-free operation. It has a tremendous amount of overhead associated with it, especially if you're coming out of when you have to do EVAs out of the space station, where you're coming out of a 14.7 environment or whatever it is in kips per square meter or what you folks use now. What is it in the metric system? Is it
instead of
we still talk about PSIs?
Do you? All right.
Supposed to, but we do.
14.7, and you got the pre-breeze requirements, and you got the suit maintenance overhead. So EVA is it's a tool. It's something that ought to be utilized when it fits or when it's necessary. But I think we shouldn't go EVA happy, as it were, to design a space station. So we, from the astronaut office point of view, would really like to see the EVA requirement minimized. We don't. We think it's a neat thing to do when it's necessary.
Yeah, which you're probably watching with interest the amount the Russians do over the next couple of years, because they seem to be putting more emphasis on EVA and testing.
Well, I think structures. What it is they have seen the things that we've done, and have now been not so reluctant to use it, to the extent that they may overshoot a little the other way and say, shoot, that's a
even at the higher pressure inside the suit.
What was causing the thing to the oil to wrap against the thing? I mean, there's no wind or anything up there.
It's what we call a Ku band antenna, which we use for two things. One is a radar to to measure distance, and as a communications antenna.
Right.
And the control function had just malfunctioned.
Oh, I see. You know, right.
It's the computer points it at a satellite all the time when we're
right.
talking to the satellite to the ground.
Right. Right.
And as we go over the Earth, it moves it around. Well, that's that attitude
right.
control had malfunctioned just for a while, and it was
right.
banging
right.
against the side.
Yeah, I just got to think about it. Well, I wonder why it was banging along the side. I mean, you know, like,
well, it was a
sense.
Malfunction, and we just switched to an alternate control mode, and it worked okay.
Mm.
We had never thought about that ahead of time.
Yeah.
For, you know, like, about 5 seconds,
you're
like, oh, my God.
Good
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Sure.